This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do with an extra hour in your day? Go for a run? Read a book? So many of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. The question is, time for what? Therapy can help you find and prioritize what matters to you so that you can do more of it. It's a great way to figure out your goals, enhance your problem-solving skills, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartwisdom today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartwisdom.
Welcome to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We are delighted to share with you Jack's innate common sense and his clear, open heart. In order to continue presenting these podcasts, we need your support. Please go to mindpodnetwork.com/jack, and you can donate there, or you can go through our Amazon or Audible affiliate links. And that's another great way to support the podcast. Thank you for your generous attention.
So here we are, taking birth, human incarnation, 101, right? But you start over and over each time. It's you kind of wish you, you know, could move to 102 or something like that, but you forget a lot of what you might have learned and if you believe in another incarnation. But anyway, here you are. You're in this strange human body with the tainted glory, to use Oscar Wilde's phrase, of humanity. And we're going into the darkest time of the year, and there are two kinds of darkness. There's the fertile darkness, that is the pregnant void, the darkness out of which all things arise and are born. That's the darkness that contains the potential of creation. And you know, when the physicists talk about outer space and talk about if they can even find some area that doesn't have any physical matter in it, although it's still filled with the, you know, X-rays and gamma rays and all those other things that are passing through it, there's an enormous energy in the vacuum. It's like it just wants to burst forth. So there's the fertile, pregnant darkness that gives birth to all things, the background. They call it dark matter, you know, that kind of thing, 98% or 88% or whatever it is. They haven't figured that out. Dark energy, it's kind of cool. And then there's the other kind of darkness, which is the darkness of blindness in an unhealthy way, the unseeing, the unconscious darkness. And to awaken, to live in a conscious way, we both have to awaken to what's light and luminous, but we also have to awaken to darkness. And it's not particularly easy. One of the Hindu sages, he writes, "Go ahead, light your candles, candle time, solstice, burn your incense, ring your bells, call out to the gods, but watch out, because the gods will come. And they will put you on their anvil and fire up the forge and beat you until they turn brass into pure gold." So anybody who's ever meditated for a little while understands this in a kind of personal and intimate way. You sit, I'm going to be joyful, peaceful, filled with light. And then Mara and your own personal demons appear as well. Yes, you have beautiful light, but also you have your worries and anxieties, your physical pains, your unfinished business and grief, your loneliness and boredom, your fears and aversions, your aggression, your death, all those things come visit you. So there you are having a nice meditation, right? And there are stages in the meditation manuals where I train that are called the stages of terror, the stages of facing your death. So it's not like it's a mistake. It's looking at human incarnation. And it's not like somebody else has the problem. You've been born with this human dilemma of joy and sorrow and gain and loss and praise and blame and longing and love and violence as well. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who says, if only it were all so simple, if only it were necessary just to separate, let's see, how does he start that? One second. I'm trying to do it by memory, but so. He says, if only there were evil people out there insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were just simple, we could separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who among us is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? So you sit, and if you're honorable in your meditation, you find everything in there, because you are part of the cosmos and part of humanity with its joys and its terrors. And then you open your eyes to this world. Plato said, only the dead know the end of war. So there's continuing warfare and racism and injustice and cruelty. There's also waterfalls and flamingos and mangoes and chocolate, you know. I mean, it's wild. And to awaken is to sense this mystery of it all. And here we are, this week in the DRC, the Democratic Republic. I like that they've got both parties in their name. The Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the worst killing fields probably since World War II. The number of children who are killed, the number of women who are being raped, the number of young people who are being impressed into the army. And it goes on week after week and year after year. And it's just one place on the planet. It's one of the most dire. We don't really pay attention to it, but there it is, and it's us as humans. And it's a wealthy, fertile, beautiful land. Or this week, and sort of this is the build-up, you wonder why I'm talking about this stuff, is I want to talk about Connecticut and Sandy Hook and the gunning down of innocence, which is almost unbelievable. It takes your breath away. Unbearable, senseless carnage. And it's there, so we see it and feel it. We don't see it when it happens in a village in the Congo or when it happens to girls in rural, you know, Afghanistan or someplace. But here it was. It's made visible to us in some terrible, terrible way, almost unbearable. And so we have a task if we are to live honorably, if we are to live an awake life. The first task, perhaps two, is to not let the outer ignorant darkness, that kind of darkness, take over your heart. To not let that come in and poison you. But the second task, which is equally important, is to not avert your gaze. To not let yourself turn away because you can't bear it. So Ram Dass was teaching a class, dear friend Ram Dass, author of Be Here Now in the 60s and so forth, in Oakland a couple of decades ago on service as a path to awakening the heart. And after some weeks of the class, talking about how you paid attention to the people around you and how you offered things and what was going on in you as you served the world. A woman raised her hand and said, I've been really learning something in this class. He said, would you tell your story? So she said, every day on my way to work for the last year, there's a homeless guy who sits near the BART station and I put money in his cup. He's just become one of my people. And I, you know, just as I pay my money to get on BART, I offer him something every morning. And it feels very good to do it. But after our classes, I realized that I'd never really looked at him. I've never really looked him in the eye. And so I started to pay attention as I did it, and I went to give him the money. And I realized I was afraid to look him in the eye. And then I understood why I was afraid to look him in the eye. Because she said, if I really looked at him, I was afraid that he would be moved to my living room couch for the rest of the year if I really looked him in the eye. And I didn't know what to do with that. You understand? So it's neither to let the violence and the ignorance of that kind of darkness take over your heart so you drown in it, nor is it to avert your gaze. Now, the Buddha teaches that we should look not just at the results, but at causes and conditions. And in Connecticut, what happened is the result of a lot of causes and conditions. How do we deal with mental illness in this culture? And I know, you know, we use medication, but it's too quick sometimes. Don't even talk to people. And I also know somebody in my extended family who was put on medication, a relatively young person who committed suicide shortly after because they weren't being tracked for their antidepressant. And it has that other effect. There's all this weird stuff. And now we don't talk to people. We just medicate them in some way or other. And our prisons are actually our default mental hospitals. Mental hospitals are closed. Imagine being, you know, having mental illness and then being stuck in a prison. What kind of civilization? You know, or you can talk about somebody shooting people as a kind of twisted attempt to get attention. The old adage, it's better to be wanted by the police than not wanted at all, right? Or the weird drugs like bath salts and things that are around. But also there's the celebration of the pornography of violence in this culture. The video games, I mean, just go to watch the new James Bond movie, right, and watch all the trailers because it's the action movie trailers you get. And it's like half an hour of people shooting one another up and blowing things up and killing one another. What fun. And not only that, we export it. So I remember starting to travel around, you know, in different countries 20, 30, 40 years ago, American movies, Rambo was the big thing in Mongolia or Indonesia or Africa or things like that. That's real America. I mean, come on. We do this. And then on top of the celebration of violence is our hyper-individualistic cowboy frontier man archetype, right? That you're going to do it all yourself. But forget that the cowboy, you know, that his gun was actually made by somebody else somewhere. And so was his axe and his pump handle and, you know, the candle or kerosene lamp. The idea that you're not connected with other people is crazy. And yet we live this kind of archetype. We'll be self-sufficient, and then the others, the communists or the UN's black helicopters or the Muslims or the immigrants, somebody's not going to get us. We'll protect ourselves somehow. And we're a warlike nation. If you look at our history, the last century plus, we've almost not been at peace. We've been at one war after another. Now we're doing two at once. See, we're multitasking. And we're the largest weapons exporter on the face of the earth. We're headed into the solstice, by the way. You want to talk about darkness, we're going through it for a moment. Because it's in your heart. You have Connecticut there. And it's not just those children, but it's the causes and conditions that we as a society have to at least not turn away from. We have the largest military budget, more than the next 10 military budgets of all other countries in the world. We supply $100 billion of killing machines every year to other parts of the world, and then we get afraid that we're not so safe. Funny. And it's crazy. As John Stewart said, one failed attempt at a shoe bomb, and we all have to take our shoes off. 31 school shootings since Columbine, and no change in our gun laws. So that's the reptilian brain, in case you hadn't noticed. There's the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain, and then there's some higher functioning. But we can trigger the fear in each other, the survival fear, very easily. And we get, you know, fearful and fundamentalist and all these kinds of ways very, very easily. So what are we to do? Mourn, yes, weep. But also stand up for a different world. Not just mourn and weep. So the violence and the misunderstanding has to be met with some equal force. And it's really the force of love and a kind of courage that's a different part of who we are, but an equally important and valuable and genuine human part. Now, one of the good things I can say tonight, I was reading Steven Pinker's book, some of you may know it, The Better Angels of Our Nature. He's anthropologist, historian, philosopher, it's brilliant. And, you know, Bill Gates says, maybe the most important book I've ever read. Wall Street Journal calls it masterly, but so also does MSNBC. Fox. I mean, it's like all across the spectrum. And what his thesis is, that the world is actually getting better. That if you look over the last 4 or 5 centuries, that the kind of global changes are, there's less violence, there is a gradual abolishment of capital punishment in many parts of the world, a gradual abolishment of slavery, a gradual abolishment of despotism. There is an understanding that even though it still happens, genocide is wrong. There is an increase in civil rights, an increase in women's rights and the way women are treated, and gay rights and the rights of children. There isn't so much child labor anymore, although there is some. He goes on and on. By various different measures and markers, even though we're pretty damn uncivilized, we're getting better. That's a really important thing to say at this time. Now, just so it doesn't go to your head, at the University of Chicago, Imdal Ben Ami Bartal and Jean Desity did a study of rats, and they were giving them chocolate chips. These were really happy rats. But they had a captive rat in a cage next to a free rat, and they could hear the distress calls of the captive rat. And the free rat learned with greater time how to open the cage for the captive rat, even if it wasn't getting any reward. And not only that, it saved a chocolate chip or two for that rat. It did. Okay, so it doesn't go to your head, right? So built into Darwin, and if you read Darwin, Darwin did a whole book on compassion and interdependence. He didn't just talk about the survival of this, you know, the fittest, but he did a whole thing about interdependence that we don't read about. We only read Cowboy Darwin, but there's a whole other part of Darwin that's really worthy of looking at. It's not just the survival of the fittest, it's the survival of those who collaborate. It's the web of interdependence. It's life as a field that we are a part of. Now, the thing that's true is that this wisdom that's not the reptilian brain or maybe even the mammalian brain, although the rats seem to have a pretty, you know, they got both sides like we do. Not only is it natural to us in some way, but also it can be reminded, awakened, trained, supported. The capacity that we have not just to act from the impulses of fear and violence and prejudice and racism and those things. Those are one part of our consciousness and brain. We actually don't have to follow them. And the Buddha said, he said, if it were not possible to train you to do this, I wouldn't teach. But just because it is possible for us, so I offer these practices. How to incline the mind. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel. Thus we will incline the mind. Others will kill living beings. We will not kill living beings. Thus we will incline the mind. Others will take what doesn't belong to them. We will abstain from taking what belongs to them. Thus we will incline the mind. Others will speak maliciously and untruthfully. We will speak kindly and truthfully. Thus we will incline the mind. Others will be envious. We will not be envious. Thus we'll incline the mind. Others will be arrogant. We will not. Thus we'll incline the mind. Others will be harsh without compassion. We shall establish compassion. Thus we should incline the mind. Others will lack wisdom. We shall cultivate wisdom. Thus we shall incline the mind. And it's a reminder for us as a humanity that this is also our birthright. This is also possible. Now, in the ancient stories, in the forests of India of that time, when the Buddha, as the story is told, gave instructions to monks and nuns of how to quiet their mind and develop a sense of mindful awareness and an inner sense of freedom, he sent them off into the forests and jungles to meditate. And in this particular occasion, a group of them came running back because the forest that they were sent into was filled with wild animals and strange sounds of ghosts and spirits. And they said, "We're terrified. We can't practice there. Help us." And he said, "I'll give you a protection that will work in the forests of the wild animals," which are mostly the wild animals in your own mind, by the way, just to get this clear. And the spirits. And that was the first occasion in these teachings, anyway, when he offered the systematic instruction on loving-kindness meditation. He said, if you can learn to dwell in your heart, offering love to all beings, that will be a protection no matter where you go. People will sense it and love you more, you know. Your health will be better. Your mind will be quieter, you'll fall asleep easily, you'll waken contented. Your children will be happier. Elephants will bow as you go by. There's a whole long list of all this. It's called unconditional friendliness. And it's really a beautiful teaching and practice. And you kind of, as most of you know who've done the loving kindness meditation, you start very simply by awakening the sense, the wishing, well-wishing for yourself and others. And then you extend it to all living beings, weak or strong, young or old, born or yet to be born, long or short, no legs, two legs, many legs, four legs, however, whatever form, far and near. And you begin to extend the friendliness of your heart. Now, the thing is that love, which is so mysterious, it's like gravity. I think it's because we were all together in the singularity, the physicists call it. That's where you used to live 13.6 billion years ago today, as Wes would say, right? And then you exploded into, you know, stars, galaxies, planets. 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth was a ball of molten stone. Now it can sing opera, as Brian Swim likes to say. That love is like gravity, cosmic allurement. It's that sense that we actually all belong to one another. And when we feel it, when we open ourselves to it, we know that this is true. And we've all fallen in love, and we've all had our days of love. And we all have known what it's like to gaze with the eyes of love upon another or a creation. Or as the Buddha said, to hold another being the way a mother holds her most beloved child. But when love, which is called one of the four states of the awakened heart, this is the developed heart and mind that we have a capacity for, when love is awakened, it also changes flavor. When love meets pain and suffering, it turns into compassion. Because you can't wish, oh, sweet, happy love when someone's child has just died. You can't love sweet, happy love when somebody is in great fear and pain and suffering. And so instead, that touch of love in the place of sorrow transforms it into the heart of compassion. And it's not only the children in Connecticut whose names are listed here, 6 years old, 7 years old, 6 years old, Grace and Jesse and Catherine and Madeline and Dylan and Lauren and Noah and Benjamin. It's not only those children, but it's all the children who are really all our children. And especially it's all the children who are hungry, who are unprotected, who are sick, whose parents can't take care of them, whose parents can't protect them, which there are. And so when the door of compassion opens, it's not just for one being, but it starts to sense and feel the compassion for life. But love also can meet beauty and turn into joy, mudita, the joy of being part of this amazing creation. Alice Walker, she writes, I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. People think pleasing God is all God care about, but any fool living in the world can see it's always trying to please us back. And so it's also important, just as there's tragedy, that there is also beauty. And that you don't want to deny joy or happiness. To deny your happiness is to lessen the importance of the deprivation of others. And it doesn't help for you not to feel the happiness that's given to you and then to use it to offer it. It's like Wes Nisker, colleague, friend, who went to talk to Gary Snyder, interview him a few months ago. Gary's 84 and this extraordinary poet, environmentalist, Pulitzer Prize winner, who's been doing the environmental consciousness raising for half a century, one of our great teachers in that way. And he said, Gary, he started the interview, you know, with global warming and environmental destruction and loss of species and so forth, what do you say as one of our elders? You know, what do you say to people? How do you advise us? And he looked and he said, first thing he said is, don't feel guilty. He said, that doesn't help. He said, if you're going to save it, it's not going to be saved out of your guilt. Love it. Walk in it, you know, breathe it, touch it, you know, see its flowers, love a tree, find a place that matters to you. Find the joy in life and let that love be what inspires you to save what you can. And the same for meditation. It's not meant to be a grim duty, although it has its tough parts, because you sit with yourself. I like nothing more in the world than just listening, sitting on my ass, being happy, doing nothing. And it's not my fault that I have this attitude, writes Laurie Chapman, because I happen to have an amazingly comfortable ass. It may not look like much, but if you could sit on this baby for 2 minutes, you'd realize that getting off this ass would be a crime against nature. So there's love, and there is. There's compassion, oceans of it, because there's so much sorrow. But there's also almost unbearable beauty, and it keeps being reborn. And you can't deny that either. And then there's the deep peace that comes to the heart when we rest and see the magnificence of this dance we're born into. And when we come still, our stillness becomes like a mirror for those around us to see. As Yeats says, we can make our minds so like still water that beings gather around us that they may live to see their own, that they may see their own images, and so live for a moment with a clearer, perhaps even a fiercer life because of our quiet. That that too is a gift of the awakened heart, just to be still and see the magnificence of it as it is. So these are the dimensions of the awakened heart. And the gift is that with training, it's possible to do this. So my friend and colleague and teacher Mahagosananda, who was the Gandhi of Cambodia, we lived in this forest monastery doing loving kindness meditation over and over and over again. And then he built these temples in the refugee camps and did 15 years of walking people on foot through the killing fields back to their villages, chanting loving kindness over and over, saying you can't return home without every step offering a prayer of love to reclaim the land that you've lived on from this war. Only then will you feel that you're home. And it's because he trained to do it, he actually could carry it. It was an amazing thing to see. Dina Metzger, the poet, activist, friend, she says, give me everything mangled and bruised, and I will make a light of it to make you weep, and we will have rain, and we will begin again. And we do. We start over and over and over again, and it is possible to do this for you. And we all hold in some way this imagination, whether it's Nelson Mandela walking out of prison 27 years in Robben Island with so much magnanimity and graciousness, or Aung San Suu Kyi, or whoever it is that you carry, we all know it. We know it's a human possibility. So Dante, you remember him, the author of the Divine Comedy, was standing near the Ponte Vecchio, the bridge that crosses the Arno River in Florence. It was about 1285 or 1290, just before 1300. And Dante saw Beatrice standing on the bridge. He was a young man, she even younger, and that vision contained the whole of eternity for him. Dante didn't speak to her and saw her very little, and then Beatrice died, carried off by the plague. Dante was stricken with the loss of his vision, for she was the connection between his soul and heaven itself. You know what it's like to fall in love. 650 years later, during World War II, the Americans were chasing the German army up the Italian peninsula. The Germans were blowing up everything of aid to the progression of the American army, including the bridges across all the rivers. But no one wanted to blow up the Ponte Vecchio, because Beatrice had stood on it and Dante had written about her. So the German commandant made radio contact with the Americans and in plain language said they would leave the Ponte Vecchio intact if the Americans would promise not to use it. And the promise held. The bridge was not blown up and not one American soldier or piece of equipment went across it. We're such hard-bitten people that we need hard-bitten proof of things, and this is the most hard-bitten fact of love that I know to present to you. The bridge was spared in a modern, ruthless war because Beatrice had stood upon it. So we also carry this in us, each one of us, in this amazing way. O nobly born, says the Buddha, do not forget who you really are. And the Dharma, which is the word that means truth, teachings, all these kind of things, is really the Dharma of the heart. And the point isn't to perfect yourself. You've tried that, didn't work, right? Therapy, gym, whatever. The point is to perfect your love. And it's all kinds. It's individual and global and, oh, this is Pablo Neruda, one of his love sonnets. When I die, I want your hands on my eyes, I want the light and wheat of your beloved hands to pass their freshness over me once more. I want to feel the softness that changed my destiny. What a boyfriend, huh? William Blake said, if one is to do good, it must be done in the minute particulars. General good is a plea of the flatterer, the scoundrel, and the hypocrite. So in the end, there aren't really very many questions when you come to the end of life. You know, what matters? Did I love well? Was I forgiving, gracious, open-hearted? If you didn't love well, what was it for? Maybe did I live fully, too? Did I give myself to life? There's a beautiful poem called, In the Evening You Will Be Examined on Love. It's the first line of it. The great blue book in the sky. So a story to read you that some of you know. It was Thursday, Christmas. Our family had spent the days before the holiday in San Francisco with my husband's parents. But in order for us to be back at work in Los Angeles, we found ourselves driving the 400 miles to Southern California on Christmas Day. It was normally an 8-hour drive, but with kids, it can be a 14-hour endurance test. When we could stand it no longer, we stopped for lunch in King City, a little metropolis made up of 6 gas stations and a diner. And it was into that one diner that the 4 of us trooped, road weary and saddle sore. As I sat Eric, our 1-year-old, in a high chair, I looked around the room. The restaurant was nearly empty. We were the only family, and ours were the only children. Everyone else was busy eating, talking quietly, aware perhaps that we were all somehow out of place on this special day. My reverie was interrupted when I heard Eric squeal with glee, "Hi there!" 2 words he thought were one. "Hi there!" He pounded his fat baby hands, whack, whack, on the metal high chair tray, his face alive with excitement, eyes wide, gums bared in a toothless baby grin. He wriggled and chirped, and then I saw the source of his merriment, and my eyes couldn't take it all in at once. A tattered rag of a coat, dirty, greasy, and worn, baggy pants, a spindly body, toes that poked out of old, old shoes, and a face like none other, gums as bare as Eric's, hair uncombed, unwashed, whiskers too short to be called a beard. I was too far away to smell him, but I knew he smelled, and his hands were waving in the air, flapping about on loose wrists. "Hi there, baby. Hi, big boy. I see you, Buster." My husband and I exchanged a look that was a cross between, "What do we do?" and, "Oh, poor devil." Eric continued to laugh and answer, "Hi there." Every call was echoed. I noticed waitresses' eyebrows shoot to their foreheads and several people sitting near us ahemmed out loud. This old geezer was creating a nuisance with my beautiful baby. I shoved a cracker at Eric and he pulverized it on the tray. I thought, "Why me?" under my breath. The meal came and the nuisance continued. Now the old bum was shouting from across the room, "Do you know Patty Cake? Attaboy, you know Peekaboo? Look, he knows Peekaboo." Nobody thought it was cute. The guy was probably drunk and a definite disturbance. I was embarrassed. My husband was humiliated. Even our 6-year-old said, "Why is that old man talking so loud?" We ate in silence, except Eric, who was running through his repertoire for the admiring applause of a Skid Row bum. Finally, I had enough. I turned the high chair. Eric screamed and clambered around to face his old buddy. Now I was really mad. Dennis went to pay the check, imploring me to get Eric and meet me in the parking lot. I trundled Eric out of the high chair and looked toward the exit. The old man sat poised, waiting, his chair directly between me and the door. "Lord, just let me out of here before he speaks to me or Eric," and I headed to the door. It soon became apparent that both the Lord and Eric had other plans. As I drew closer to the man, I turned my back, walking to sidestep him. And as I did so, Eric, all the while his eyes riveted on his new best friend, leaned far over my arm, reaching with both arms in the baby's pick-me-up position. In a split second of balancing my baby and turning to counter his weight, I came eye to eye with the old man. Eric was lunging for him, arms spread wide. The old bum's eyes asked, implored, would you let me hold your baby? There was no need for me to answer since Eric propelled himself from my arms into the man's. Suddenly, a very old man and a very young baby were involved in a love relationship. Eric laid his tiny head upon the man's ragged shoulder, and the man's eyes closed, and I saw tears hover beneath the lashes. His aged hands, full of grime and pain and hard labor, gently, so gently, cradled my baby's bottom and stroked his back. The old man rocked and cradled Eric in his arms for a moment, and then his eyes opened and he set squarely on mine, said in a firm, commanding voice, "Now you take proper care of this baby." And somehow I managed, I will, from a throat that contained a stone. He pried Eric from his chest, unwillingly, longingly, as though he was in pain. I held my arms open to receive my baby, and again the gentleman addressed me. "God bless you, ma'am. You've given me my Christmas gift." I said nothing more than a muttered thanks, and with Eric back in my arms, I ran for the car. Dennis wondered why I was crying and holding Eric so tightly and why I was saying, "My God, don't let me forget. Please don't let me forget." So what matters when the rains come or the tears or tragedy, that kind of darkness, or the darkness of this season? It becomes the time to quiet your mind and listen to your heart, not avert your gaze, but to set your intention most deeply. What are you doing with this human life? To turn the compass of your heart to what really matters. That's what's called for. The Bodhisattva vows are one way that people do it, to take a vow in yourself. This is what I want to do with my life. Diane Ackerman, a modern Bodhisattva vows that I love. In the name of daybreak and the eyelids of morning, and the wayfaring moon and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, a healer of misery, a messenger of wonder, an architect of peace. Or the Dalai Lama who wakes up in every morning, 4 in the morning, 3:30, says the same vows in a different form from Shantideva. May I be medicine for all who are sick. May I be a boat or a raft or a bridge for all to cross over the stream. May I be food for the hungry, a lamp for those who've lost their way in the darkness. May I be a resting place for the weary. May I bring inspiration and care and illumination as long as the world, earth, and sky exist, and longer until I and all beings awaken together. Some little vow like that, for those kind of things. But it actually works. Henry David Thoreau, "Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders." And there are the outer seeds that we plant. But this really speaks of the seeds in the heart. What do you plant? And what do you plant in the dark time of the year when everyone lights candles and waits for the earth to make its turning and the sun to again begin to re-illuminate the world? But it's the seeds of loving kindness. Ursula Le Guin, love doesn't just sit there like a stone. It has to be made like bread. remade all the time, made new every morning for breakfast. And so you read the loving kindness practice, and its instruction is omitting none. Sitting and opening the heart with loving kindness toward oneself, one's loved ones, one's benefactor, one's community, one's family, one's friends, the beings and creatures around, thick and thin, tall and short, young and old, north, south, east and west, with the sublime abiding of love directing this in every direction. And then adding compassion for the parents, the families, for all those who've lost someone, who are frightened. I suppose this is really the lighting of the inner candle. Angela Salesis, the Christian mystic, says, "If in your heart you make a manger for his birth, then Christ will once again become born on this earth." So that's really where the manger lives.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Jack Kornfield Heart Wisdom Hour. We appreciate your support, and we ask you to continue that support by going to mindpodnetwork.com/Jack. Look forward to seeing you next week.